You're listening to Pep Talk, discussing policy, evidence and practice in Wales. Pep Talk is brought to you by the Wales Centre for Public Policy at Cardiff University.
Hello, croeso I Pep Talk. Welcome to Pep Talk. Even before the coronavirus pandemic, loneliness among older people was a priority issue for the Welsh Government, local government and public and community services in Wales. While loneliness can affect anyone at any age, policymakers have long recognised that older people can be especially vulnerable, particularly if they live alone, experience poor health, or rely on help and support to be able to participate in social activities. Loneliness can also be severely detrimental to older people's health and well-being, with evidence that loneliness is associated with earlier mortality, increased risk of cardiovascular diseases, dementia, and a range of other physical and mental health problems, including depression. In recent years, as the evidence on the very serious health impacts of loneliness has accumulated, experts have increasingly called for loneliness to be regarded as a public health crisis. In February 2020, the Welsh Government published its Connected Community Strategy and announced £1.4 million of funding for community organisations to test and deliver innovative approaches to tackling loneliness and social isolation. The timing would prove to be unexpectedly significant, with the UK government announcing a national lockdown in response to the COVID-19 pandemic only a month later. As we all remember, this began a long period of measures requiring physical distancing and restrictions on social contact in order to control community transmission of the virus. In this time, the impacts of loneliness became a growing concern across the world, within and alongside the wider global health emergency of the pandemic. Of course, one particularly cruel irony of the pandemic was that it not only increased loneliness and isolation, it also took away many of our existing strategies for tackling loneliness. Before COVID-19, many of these approaches tended to focus on increasing the quantity and/or the quality of people's in-person social contacts. Physical distancing and shielding to slow the spread of the virus made in-person social contact impossible, so people and organisations had to look for other approaches. What this led to was a massive acceleration of the use of digital technologies to enable social connection. In the wake of this period of physical distancing and shielding, we at Wales Centre for Public Policy have been working with the University of Bath on a major research study into how digital and other technologies have been used to tackle loneliness among older people in Wales during the pandemic. Were these approaches effective? Did they help reduce lockdown loneliness for older people? And what lessons can we draw for future efforts to tackle loneliness? I'm your host, Josh Coles-Riley, and with me today to help unpack these questions are Professor Julie Barnett, John Gallanders, and Carol Barrett. My first guest is Professor Julie Barnett, who is professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Bath and was the lead researcher on this study. Julie, very briefly, can you tell us what you were hoping to find out about from this study?
Yeah, thanks, Josh. So, this was a really interesting study to be involved in. And I think against the backdrop that you've just outlined there, that we were really wanting to understand how a new and existing technology was used in Wales to address loneliness and social isolation among older adults across the course of the pandemic. And within that, we were really interested in what sort of barriers or facilitators existed around that and what the benefits and even the downsides might be of using technology to address loneliness and social isolation. And in the end, you know, we wanted to understand how services can best take our findings into account and to capitalize on that.
How did you go about using the study to try and shed light on these questions?
Yeah, so in terms of our methods, you know, what we really wanted to access was the experts in the area. So, of course, we had our experts by experience group, and that was really important to actually sort of setting the scope and the focus of the project. But when we actually went into the project itself, we wanted to access the views of health and social care professionals. We did that in two ways, through a survey and through qualitative work, which is always so important to really, get to the detail of some of the context. And we also did interviews with older people in Wales, service users that had, in some cases hadn't, had access to technology and engaged with technology over the course of the pandemic.
Today, we're also joined by John Gallanders and Carol Barrett, both members of an Experts by Experience steering group that helped inform this research and how it was conducted. John, would you mind just telling me a bit about what this involved?
Yes, there were a number of meetings that I attended with the team, giving feedback around some personal experience and experience from other organisations, because I come from the third sector and picked up a lot of understanding around how technology was changing with organisations and individuals. So it's helped all along in the process, really, to add some information from the ground into the research.
And Carol, you were also involved in the steering group and in the research. Can you tell us what motivated you to get involved in this research?
Yeah, I've become increasingly concerned that digital technology is being rolled out without any thought about how it interacts with the elderly. I didn't grow up in a digital world. The first time I ever had anything to do with computers in 1976 was the last year of my first degree. I did my computer programming basic course on the mainframe computer with punch tape. 3 years later, for my second degree, we had two PCs in the biochemistry department that you had to program yourself. So I've got an analog brain in a digital world. Nothing is intuitive to me. I have to think it through. I was at home for 18 years with my kids, and then I went back and worked in a medical diagnostics manufacturer. I became a senior manager. I had to learn my IT, and I did. But I've seen people my age, I'm coming up for 68, I've seen people my age switch off. They don't want to know the moment it gets difficult, or they don't want to know per se. And this rush in public services to make everything digital is disenfranchising a lot of elderly people, and also poor people who don't have Wi-Fi. So that's why I have got involved.
And I think a lot of these issues were issues that kind of surfaced in the research, and that we'll come on to in this conversation in more detail. But yeah, thank you all for joining me today. I want to sort of start by exploring the significance of this study and its findings. John, why do you think this research is important?
I think there are a few specifics. I mean, picking up on Carol's point over age, for a start, I think if we actually look, probably nobody over the age of 45 actually was taught in school how to use a computer. Or if they did, they would have had a BBC Acorn stuck in the corner of the room and everybody huddled around it. So I think we need to acknowledge that lots of people in that generation, so it's not the traditional sort of 60 age upwards, but lots of people have actually learnt on the hoof. And I think as a consequence, not everybody fully understands what you can actually do with technology. The fact that organisations and families swiftly moved on to where they could afford it or had access onto Zoom type meetings. How many professionals hadn't really thought about technology because they themselves previously would have had to go and book a video conference room in order to have a video meeting with somebody, yet the technology was there on their desktop. So I think professionals struggled to come to terms with that. But crucially, I think for some older people, they might have seen it very much as being, oh, it's another fad. It's one of these things that will come. If I got a problem, I'll ask my grandchild or the youngest person in the family because they'll know how to deal with it. And, you know, they were the IT experts in the family. But I think also for me on the research side, it was to find out what were the barriers to people engaging with technology. And Carol's alluded to things like sort of the costs for being able to get broadband, etc. But it was also around whether during the lockdown, those who'd got access to technology, did they actually become closer together as a result? Because they would book a particular time where they would have a family quiz and you'd get all the family members coming together, whereas normally it might just have been the odd family member popping in to see mum or dad or whoever, whereas that actually brought some families closer, but equally recognising there were lots of barriers to that. The point is, has COVID gone away? Because we've got to acknowledge lots of this rapid change came from COVID. The answer is COVID is still there. We've got the threats of major flu pandemics. So going forward, we still have a lot of older people who are actually still lack the confidence to go out, meet people face to face. but we also seem to have had a downturn in the use of technology to engage with people. It's almost as if people have got fed up of that. Whether during the winter months now, coming in the next period, people will start to re-embrace, because the people I talk to now, they say, no, oh, it's a long time since I've had a family quiz or a family WhatsApp message. So that's an issue. And then the final point is around the technology itself, particularly organisations. And Carol said, you know, about Teams. Professionals tended to think everything needed to be done by Teams or Zoom, when in fact the public themselves were using things like FaceTime or WhatsApp, the more social savvy type apps. And it took a long time for people to, I think, in authority to recognise that. And there are still barriers, because a lot of organisations still say they won't communicate on those because of security reasons. So I think it's around how organisations, individuals adapt to the technology which is readily available, and we end up finding platforms which are suitable for everybody to be using.
Fantastic. Thanks, John. That was a really, really helpful overview of some of the significance of this research. Just in terms of the angle on loneliness itself and whether these uses of technology might help us address loneliness among older people, and thinking about situating this research in terms of the pandemic. Julie, during the introduction to the episode, that was one of the things that I talked about, was the potential impacts the pandemic had on loneliness. Obviously, we're now more than 2 years on from the start of the pandemic. So what do we now know about the impacts it's had on loneliness among older people?
Yeah, thanks, Josh. I mean, that's an important question. And I think overall, you know, work from the ONS, work from other organisations that are involved in this area, is, you know, the general consensus is that, especially where people were lonely before the pandemic, that actually they got lonelier. And that generally there were increased levels of loneliness. It's hard to be absolutely categorical about that, because we often don't have longitudinal studies that really help us look at change over time. We tend to have research that is just snapshots. But even so, that would be the general consensus. And I think, you know, another area just to bear in mind here is, I think, you know, John and Carol have alluded to, is the fact that, you know, there is a lot of digital exclusion, digital poverty. In 2020, of the 3 million people that had never used the internet, 98% of those people were over 50. So that's the sort of baseline that we're coming from. But it's not even about people that have never used. It's also about people who don't use very much, suddenly being in a situation where actually, not just for reasons of loneliness and social isolation, but getting prescriptions delivered, making medical appointments, ordering your shopping, that all of these areas, there was a sudden, you know, challenge for people that up to now, for all sorts of reasons, had not been able to do that. So I think that's the sort of backdrop. And the other thing is to say that there really wasn't very much research about the digital and loneliness and isolation. And where there was, that was obviously in a context where face-to-face contact was absolutely common. So that's a different setting altogether within which to look at, you know, the ways in which, you know, the digital might actually support or not, in terms of preventing or ameliorating social isolation and loneliness.
Thank you, Julie. I think that 98% of the 3 million who've never used the internet before figure really kind of helps explain why this research was focusing on older people and technology specifically. During the introduction, I also talked about how during the lockdown, and you've just kind of alluded to this as well, in-person approaches weren't available to organisations that were trying to tackle loneliness, so they had to try other strategies. When you conducted the research, you surveyed and interviewed professionals that were involved in services for older people. What kinds of things were they doing during the pandemic to try and enable social connection for older people?
Yeah, thanks, Josh. So I think one thing to say in the first instance is actually that organisations needed to use that within their own organisations more than they had. And in some instances, that was challenging. You know, some working remotely and so on meant that organisations themselves were actually more reliant on using the digital in order to communicate between themselves. That's a sort of a backdrop there. You know, we saw certainly that people, older service users, were really being encouraged to link with friends and family, other organisations and so on. And one of the key things we found, which I guess is not, it's not about so much about new technology, but a huge reliance on the phone. Now, of course, the phone can range between the landline, you know, a mobile phone and a smartphone. So, and sometimes one doesn't know necessarily what you're talking to someone on, but certainly organisations really focused on the centrality of the phone. Against that backdrop, there was organisations also talked about other types of technology. Alexa, for example, as virtual assistant, you know, WhatsApp, texting and so on, as well as other new technologies. So there really was a clear view, I think, that overall some or even most people started to use things that they hadn't used before to some degree. So overall, there was a positive picture about some of the changes that have been made. I should just briefly add to say that in the survey, of course, those people that filled it in completely were organisations that were using technology. So we don't have such a clear view of those that really couldn't contribute very much because they actually weren't doing it. So in a sense, we've got that sort of expert sample. But by definition, we don't have the views of those that were in organisations that weren't, for whatever reason, set up to actually move into that space once the pandemic hit.
Thanks, Julie. That's really helpful. I'm just thinking about the kind of older people who didn't have access to kind of digital technology or who were very unfamiliar with it. I imagine that organisations were quite concerned about those people that they worked with. Were there particular strategies that they used to try and support those older people?
I mean, we certainly see the issues around, for example, the provision of devices. That was something, you know, there was evidence of that. There was evidence of a renewed focus on skills training, you know, to pick up this question, you know, I think that Carol alluded to in terms of people, you know, just not having the skills. Of course, the difficulty is when you're doing that in the heat of battle, as it were, as was the case in the pandemic, that is a very difficult thing to start doing. And what we saw, the organisations that in some sense already had those structures in place were already actually made that transition more smoothly, felt more confident, were able to, you know, to think about newer technologies and weren't starting from a place of where they've got to start from square one, as it were, to move into that space. But certainly the provision of training and skills and in some instances devices, as well as that sort of almost one-to-one support, which of course, as we know, is very difficult to do online. You know, you really want to be sitting next to someone, and those things weren't possible either. So there were, you know, difficulties around that, but that's the sort of spaces, as it were, that organisations were actually active in.
If I could just come in on that, because I think one of the issues that I saw with organisations and agencies involved with distribution of phones was very much that they saw it as a phone use only, as opposed to the add-on functionality of the internet, so or for the use of video calls with family or anybody else. And I think that was a real potential sort of failing. But as Julie said, you know, everybody was firefighting on the hoof. And linked with that, I think there's also the issue that a lot of older people tend to, particularly mobile phones, tend to have a hand-me-down mobile phone from a family member, but they're actually given the phone as, oh, here's a new phone, as opposed to here is a phone on which you can go onto the internet or you can do your shopping and things like that. So again, I think family members and what they could actually do in terms of training their older relatives in the equipment that they've given them, if you like. They were just giving them for a basic phone call as opposed to anything else.
I often get criticised by my elderly friends for spending so much time on my phone. I say, this isn't a phone. This is an incredibly powerful computer that has a phone and text function. I'm in my notes, I'm looking up information on the internet, I'm putting stuff in my diary. It is my life is on that phone, basically. It's like an office. When you think of the computer that landed man on the moon, I mean, that's why we've got PCs. I mean, these things are thousands of times more powerful and we have them in our pocket. But elderly people a lot don't understand that in many ways. You know, whether they had, you know, a basic Nokia that just would text and phone, which possibly is the best thing some of us could have, because there's not much technology to go wrong on it.
Again, it was a practical issue that a lot of agencies were actually handing phones out in various guises, but they were actually handing out ordinary smartphones or ordinary phones. They didn't take into account the fact that a lot of elderly people really needed phones with the big keypads on, that they could actually, the dexterity of the user was not taken into account. It was more, how many phones can we get out there into the community, as opposed to are we giving the right equipment to the right people at the right time?
Yeah, I will concur with that. My father, who died when he was 91, would never even get on with a mobile phone. Now, because he was a mechanical engineer, he never did electronics, and he didn't want to know about electronics, and this stuff was all electronics. And he would not engage with computers because of that. And it was such a waste, because he could have WhatsApped his grandchildren, you know, daily, but he would not get his head round it, because it was newfangled stuff that he couldn't access. And he did try a phone with big buttons, but it didn't quite do what it said on the tin, and was very frustrating. He just got rid of them, threw it away, and stayed writing letters.
And the other bit of training that wasn't given either was, and I suppose it's embracing technology fully, which was actually around voice commands. As far as I'm aware, no agency actually taught anybody how to do voice commands on a smartphone, so they wouldn't have even needed to be pressing buttons and all the rest of it. So, you know, there's a big steep learning curve over what is the functionality. And it may well be that the people who are doing the training and distribution, they themselves had not used voice commands.
Above all, whatever platform you use, it has to be reliable. The moment it doesn't work, an elderly person will just quit. Now, if you're trying to get over loneliness, it's only going to make them feel even more lonely and cut off.
These are all really, really good points. Thanks, John and Carol. Julie, I was going to ask, I think a lot of what Carol and John have just talked about really resonates with some of the things that came through your research. Do you have any kind of observations on that?
Yeah, just to really pick up this, you know, on the points that John and Carol have made so well around the phone, is that, you know, one of our sort of recommendations in the end was that actually, in a sense, the phone has got the potential, if you like, to be this sort of gateway device, this bridge between actual, you know, using it for phone calls and, for example, you know, other functionality that requires on the internet. So it might be texting, but also actually video calls where you can actually see people. And, you know, it is that device that in theory can allow us to bridge, but that might need to be adapted. It might need to be managed in other sorts of ways. But I think, you know, what John and Carol have picked up nicely there is that, you know, the phone is not a full stop. It is, you know, it can be the start of something else altogether once you put it in its context as a smartphone. So that's one thing that to pick up. And I think another really important point that I would want to emphasize in this is that actually anything digital, it's a means to an end. It's not an end in itself to have these devices, that you need to use it for something. And even more so in the context of thinking about how technology can actually help to mitigate or prevent loneliness, there's got to be something and someone at the other end of it. If people don't have a reason to use it, if there's not a motivation to use it, it's not going to land in the way that it has the potential to do, to actually support making or maintaining social connection.
So what kinds of issues did older people encounter in your research in using technology for social connection?
This whole idea of, you know, the lack of confidence and familiarity. And I think it's when you are someone that does use these things, it's very, very hard to put yourself back in the place of someone to whom this is largely unfamiliar, and largely where they may not have self-evidently have reasons for doing it. So actually, when we talk to people about training, and someone said, oh, you know, they said about being online, didn't understand what online meant, you know, didn't understand the instructions around the use of the keyboard. So it's almost like the training didn't really actually, if you like, scratch people at the point that they were itching, as it were. It didn't quite fit with the needs of the people. So I think that lack of confidence, lack of familiarity, and I've also alluded there to the lack of skills. And I think one of the other things that we, of course, there's lack of, we've talked about lack of access to resources. And that's not just about hardware. It's not just about software. It's also about broadband as well. And I think that's another really important issue. But I guess the final point that I'll just make here is that where it seems like people don't have the interest or the willingness, that can actually be about these other things, not having the confidence, not having the familiarity, not being perhaps having the people that are going to be around to support it. So we shouldn't be too quick to assign something as, well, people are not interested. There may be more, much more substantial reasons that actually we, you know, that can be addressed. We shouldn't just write people off in this area just because they seem not to be interested.
That brings us a little bit on to talking about ways to address these barriers and solutions. And I want to ask John, thinking about, we've talked about some of the barriers that older people might have faced in using technology. What kinds of things do you think organisations could have been doing or could do in the future to sort of address those barriers?
Well, just as one particular point was when a lot of agencies actually gave phones out, for instance, they actually only gave a 12-month SIM. Obviously, nobody knew how long COVID was going to be going on, etc. But that created issues then over how people could actually continue because the agencies hadn't got budgets to carry on funding. But on the broader context and what Julie referenced there about broadband, in many communities, particularly those that have got CCTV systems, they could actually, the authorities could be looking at setting up free community broadband, because most of these CCTV cameras are operating on a Wi-Fi system. The signal from a technology point of view can be shared. They were going to do it in Wrexham about 6 or 7 years ago, but that never actually functioned afterwards. But if we actually look what collectively, what technology is in the community infrastructure that could be utilized? And for me, that seems a significant waste of technological opportunity, because in most office environments, so with Wi-Fi from a technology, you can split your signal to, you know, private bits, open access, etc. You go into a restaurant or a pub and they've got Wi-Fi in there, part used to run their tills and the technology for the restaurant, and the other bit is there open to the public. So the technological system is there, but it's whether the willingness from the powers that be are there to actually start really giving a broad consideration to free Wi-Fi, almost exactly the same as, well, you walk into a room and you automatically know you can turn the light on. Everybody knows if you turn the tap on, you'll get water out of it. Broadband should be seen now as part of a national infrastructure, and that's where the investment should be going.
Thanks, John. They went beyond organisations to sort of government policy, which is brilliant. I want to go back to organisations, so for my question to Julie, which we've talked about the barriers that were directly faced by older people, but your research also showed that there were kind of challenges and barriers that organisations themselves experienced in their efforts to try and support older people to use technology to connect with others. Are you able to say a bit about that side of things?
Yeah, I do think this is such an important question, Josh, and which John, to some sense, has answered, because there's a danger of actually pointing the finger, as it were, at older people themselves. And we really must focus on these things that can actually support and facilitate, and what the qualities of both infrastructure and within organisations are. So I've already alluded to actually starting to make sure that there are the appropriate levels of skill sets within organisations themselves. So that, I think, is foundational here. So, and there is this question about organisational readiness. Now, last time, I guess we had, you know, COVID was upon us in almost weeks, from not having heard of it to actually, you know, a really serious situation. And, you know, in so many ways, organisations did brilliantly and communities did brilliant to meet those needs. Now, of course, we've had that wake up call. And there is something about organisations continuing on that journey of organisational readiness in order, not just in case something like a pandemic happens, but actually just to build on that expertise more generally to actually facilitate social connections, help to build those connections and to bring the community together. So I think that's also important. You know, we saw the importance of family support. Now, of course, some people don't have families, some people don't have grandchildren, but where there are family or friends to actually, to be the person, the end, as it were, to which the digital is the means, to be on the end of the call, but also to actually sometimes to help provide the technology, sometimes to help provide the training. So that taking advantage and understanding what the existing social networks are, I think is another something that I think there's space, as it were, for organisations to move into there. Although I would just say in terms of the family support, one of the big barriers we saw on the part of older people was their concern about scams, concern about security. And for example, being concerned that inadvertently by clicking something, by replying to an email, that very bad things would happen. There was this sense of like a small mistake could lead to very negative outcomes. And again, we saw some examples of managed devices, which we've sort of John's alluded to in terms of, you know, for example, a keypad being adjusted. But there's also managed devices in the sense that someone can be alerted, the organisation can be alerted if someone's clicking into things that they, you know, is going to lead to a bad outcome. But where that links to family is sometimes the family was more concerned about it than the older person. They were worried that actually the person would inadvertently get, you know, people would get access to their bank account or something like that. So I think that the family can actually, in some senses, almost constrain by concern, you know, what it is that, you know, that older person might be doing. But generally speaking, you know, families and the social support networks were very important to thinking about how older people could make best use of technology.
So one of the things that the research was seeking to understand is what the impacts that technology use had on loneliness or the benefits that it had for those who were able to use it to connect with others. So what were those benefits, where it did work and where barriers were overcome? What were the benefits for older people that came out from your research, Julie?
I think, you know, that in the good and positive scenarios, we see, you know, a lot of benefits. And some of those things were not even about linking with other people. So we saw examples of people really benefiting and enjoying the Alexa and the sort of virtual assistant type devices. But more generally, I think, you know, in the good and the positive scenarios, we see that the possibility of digital links actually opening up new possibilities for people, transcending distance, you know, being able to go onto, you know, an event or a sort of coffee morning or a quiz or something where people were, you know, spread widely in a distance in a way that it actually wouldn't be possible to meet face to face with those people. We really saw people talking about the benefits of being able to see who you were talking to. And that, so that whole sort of, you know, being able to FaceTime or being able to ring on WhatsApp, that was beneficial. And that there was some sense of it carrying on after the pandemic, you know, that these were not things that were always necessarily just dropped at the point of moving out of the pandemic. And I guess that's sort of in, to put a different perspective to what John mentioned earlier. Having said all of that, it's really important that people do recognise that what face-to-face and what in-person contacts contributes over and above anything that virtual communication does give us. So this is not a talking about replacement, it's talking about, ideally, it's about enhancement. And of course, in the pandemic, to some extent, it was replacement. But I think, you know, there's a sense in which the technology is best when it's enhancing existing or connections or stimulating social connections in, you know, when we're starting from scratch a bit more. But we must recognise that sometimes we do see evidence, and we see this in literature as well, that there's the possibility of actually making you feel more lonely. I think Carol said earlier on I mentioned the idea that when something breaks and it just goes wrong, that can leave you feeling, you know, a little bit more, you know, desperate sometimes or isolated than were that not to have been there. And also sometimes seeing people a long distance can, you know, can make you can enhance that sense of being at a distance and so on. So, it's a complex, nuanced picture, but we certainly do see lots of the benefits as well, you know, where there's the ends as well as the means, you know, where people have got that motivation, interest and support to actually engage in those sorts of online activities.
Coming on a slight tangent here with regard to technology in its broader sense and how we're potentially going to be running the risk of creating more loneliness. So the specific examples that I'm going to give you around health. So, for instance, at the moment, people who are diabetic, they can actually have remote diagnostics done on their diabetes levels, etc. So the arm patch can actually send signals, etc., to GPs. Blood tests can actually be done online by finger pricks and analysis, and the signal just goes down the phone. For some people, for some older people, just the thought of actually going down to the local doctors because they need to have a particular test, for them is actually part of removing loneliness because they will actually come into contact with somebody. People who are older people who are on warfarin, for instance, they generally have weekly district nurses or somebody going in there doing blood tests. It's a social interaction for them. And if that is then replaced by technology, which actually just sends a pinprick blood result, they actually run the risk of actually becoming more isolated as a consequence of technology. So it's how we factor that in somehow or other, isn't it? You know, I mean, in the good old days when you had Meals on Wheels, a lot of elderly people, it wasn't actually the benefit of actually having a meal, and obviously that created independence to a certain extent, but it was actually the 10 minutes that it took for the person to deliver that meal, that 10 minutes chat was more important because it might be the only time that they would see somebody for 3, 4 or even a week sometimes.
Thank you, John. That I think that's a really important point, and it is possibly not one that was the focus of our research, but I think these are important questions for society and for policymakers and organisations to think about. We're coming to the end of our podcast. So before we finish, I have a final question, which I'm going to pose to Carol and John. Thinking about this research and the conversation we've just had, what do you think are the lessons for how we seek to tackle loneliness among older people in the future? And should we continue to look to technology for solutions? So turning to you first, Carol, what are your thoughts?
I think technology has terrific potential in many, many ways, but you younger generation who are responsible for implementing all this have to understand what I said at the beginning, that we have an analog brain in a digital world. We don't think intuitively like you think. We don't see it like you see it. We're not daft, but it's outside of our experience. I will Google something. I haven't got a clue what it is telling me to do. Not a clue. But you have to understand, we're not daft. We're not slow. We're not stupid. But we think totally differently.
John, what are your thoughts on the lessons of all this about how we should seek to tackle loneliness among older people in the future?
I think just picking up on one of Carol's points there over, you know, you do, an older person does a Google search and then you're faced with 200,000 search results. I think one of the things that needs to be clearly addressed is how do you actually come up with a trusted site that an older person knows that if they go to that, it's well thought out, it's designed in such a way specifically to help older people go through things. And it may well be, well, actually, it's you get virtual assistance or you get a chat conversation or something like that, where something is actually interactive and it's trusted, because it's that whole fear factor of some of the technology scams, etc. So there is that side. The one element to finish from me really is a potential fear factor. And the fear factor is that As technology is advancing, we're seeing more and more potential developments on the horizon. And by the horizon, I mean the near horizon rather than the distant horizon, which is very much around the creation of virtual worlds. And the more virtualness that actually gets created, then the more loneliness and isolation that could actually be occurring. Until we actually get to a point, potentially in 10 years or even less time, when the relative that you do a WhatsApp call is virtually within your room, because that is the way technology is going, and you've got a virtual person sitting in your room, which is absolutely scary thought. But you can see the way technology is going, that the people who are driving technology are young, savvy people who they live their whole life in a technological world. But the powers that be and the power of technology, you know, the large companies can drive some of these so fast that society can't cope with the pace. And older people in particular, I say older people, by that time, our 40 and 50 year olds now who are used to technology, will they embrace it in 10 to 15 years time, when they are then actually labelled as being the older person, as to how much virtualness and virtual life people will be living then?
Wow. Thanks, John. There's a lot of food for thought there to finish on. Julie, my final question for you is, and you've drawn out some of these already, but what do you think are the key considerations for policymakers and organisations that are trying to tackle loneliness among older people emerging from this research?
Yeah, thanks, Josh. So you're right, I have mentioned some of these, so I'll just mention these very briefly. But I guess the sort of context that I want to set here is, you know, this is what we're dealing with is now almost. So what can be done in this near term rather than the sort of probably medium term that John's just highlighted there? So one of the things I've mentioned already is about thinking about the way in which phones can be used as this sort of gateway transition device to actually being able to scale up the possibilities of the device, as well as, the skill sets, as it were, that people require to use those things more broadly. So I think that's one thing. I've already mentioned managed devices. I mean, of course, that's entirely dependent on resources. I mean, many of these things are dependent on resources. And, you know, we all know the constraints that we're currently operating around resources. But certainly we saw the value of managed devices as being a safer, perhaps more, you know, more appropriate for some users to have those managed devices. I guess some different things that I'll just quickly draw attention to is, we see the value in assessing the technological readiness of service users. We see that as something that can be introduced in really early meetings between health and social care professionals and service users. So just something to assess where someone is on that sort of where they are in terms of what they've got or not got in terms of hardware, skills, where there are family there that can link into that. And also something we haven't mentioned is, you know, do people have sensory impairments? Is there dementia that's got to be factored into the picture? Are people a carer? These are all things that will actually affect what type of digital possibilities they may wish to and be able to engage with. So something that could be quickly and easily embedded in normal organizational practice to assess technological readiness we see is very important. Something that's, well, I'll just finish with two things that actually almost relate more to the research than to the implications for policymakers, although they do a little bit. One is actually the importance of evaluation, you know, that we have to understand, you know, what it is. So if we evaluate, again, difficult to do when you're in the heat of battle, as it were, rather than the relative calm, if you like, of peacetime. But actually starting to think about how we evaluate these things so we can understand what is it that works, for whom is it that works, and perhaps even understand why that works. That will help us going forward. And we didn't see very much in this research about routine evaluations that were embedded in programs to increase people's use of digital devices. Secondly, I think our engagement with our youth group, and we really appreciated the input of people like Carol and John and others as well into actually shaping the sorts of things that we start to understand are important to people. We actually changed what we were asking in response to the feedback that we had. So I think that that's really important too. And then just finally, that we need to not just make it all about older people themselves, but to make it also about the capacity and the skills and the setup within organisations themselves, so that's twin focus of organisations and the service use that they're working with is really important going forward.
Thank you so much, Julie. That's been brilliant to hear. That brings our episode to a close after what's been a really fascinating and informative conversation. And I've learned a lot today, even having read the research, just from hearing John and Carol's perspectives on some of the findings. You can find more information on the reports on this research in the description box. And I'd just like to close by saying thank you so much to Julie, Carol and John for joining me today. And thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Pep Talk. Don't forget to click the subscribe button and rate us on your favourite podcasting app. And I hope you'll join us again soon for another Pep Talk.